Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to the December edition of Wireless, a series all about radio, broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, podcasting, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on this month's edition of Wireless, a new book about 30 years of local station Clare FM, how can public service radio and broadcasting generally be developed in the era of media fragmentation, the use of community radio by immigrant communities in Ireland and the US, and the development of radio in Scottish Gaelic since the 1980s.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The country's independent commercial radio stations this year celebrate 30 years on the air. Here in the west of Ireland, 1989 saw the launch of new stations in Limerick, Mayo and Clare, as well as here in Galway, all of which are still broadcasting, although Radio West was relaunched in the early 90s as Galway Bay FM. A new book has just been published about our neighbouring station Clare FM by Ger Sweeney, one of the station's broadcasters since the early days. Like many of those still involved in local radio, Ger cut his teeth in broadcasting in the Pirates in Limerick City in the 1980s. I met Ger recently in Galway when he was here selling books and putting up posters about the new publication, and I asked him to describe how he made the transition from pirate to licensed radio in 1989.
I was in Galway. We finished in Coast 103. We were broadcasting from Prospect House. That's where we were. And then a mentor of mine, the great John the Man Frawley, who was my first inadvertent commas employer in local radio or pirate radio.
In Limerick, of course.
In Limerick, yeah, with Radio Limni. And John was actually living here in Galway at the time as well. It was a few months before he died, and he was talking to me and he said, look, if you want to be involved in this, I was 21, really what you should do is apply for the licence in Limerick. And I thought he was off his head, but the more he talked, the more sense he made. And he was only 50 at the time, but he was a rock of sense in some ways. And he advised me to do that. I did it. I put a team together. Didn't understand the politics that was involved, obviously. So I was one of the five, six of us all together. One of the five disappointed. But in the process, exactly as he said, I learned quite a lot. I gathered a lot of information. I got to know a lot of people. And I got to understand what was required legally by the IRTC for anybody either setting up or working in a local radio station when it would come on stream. So after that, Clare FM were awarded the licence at the same time. And their chief executive, Cayman Jones, got to work straight away, and there was a very good team already in place. He told me that about 75% of the work for the application had been done when he came on board. So the very first ad that appeared on a local newspaper was the Clare Champion. It was an ad for the sales manager of the new radio station in Clare, Clare FM. Now, I'm not a salesman. Well, I suppose maybe I am, but I'm not a sales manager. And I certainly wasn't at 21 and going on 22. But I applied with my demo tape and my CV, which had absolutely no relevance to the job at all. And I got a letter back. And if you could read it with the tone of voice that it was probably typed, it was kind of, are you for real with this? However, thanks very much. But we'll keep you on file. And when we're looking for voices, we'll be in touch. And fair play. He was. So I got a letter from Cayman Jones a number of weeks later and said, we've heard your demo tape. We'd like you to do a voice test. Be at the RTE studios in Limerick on such a date at such a time, and we'll go from there. I did the voice test, a 15-minute programme. And 2 weeks later, I got a call to say, we'd like to offer you a job. I subsequently met with Cayman, and I was offered the job as breakfast presenter.
And breakfast presenter, obviously, very high profile, you know, one of the most listened to programmes on any station. So that was, you were definitely going in at the deep end.
I was, and I suppose it was a great vote of confidence as well. And it gave me, I suppose, some level of confidence knowing that I was going in there to do, which wasn't, in his eyes, the flagship programme, his programme on a Clare Day. The morning talk programme would have been, and certainly was, the flagship, but if they're not listening at 9 o'clock, they can't hear the flagship. So it was my job to get them out of the cot at 7 o'clock or from seven and make sure they stayed listening until nine, until Cayman took over.
And what was it like in those early days? This was the beginning of a new era in radio. Everything was quite different to the pirate era, but at the same time, many of the positive aspects of the pirate stations were still needed in order to be successful.
They were, and I suppose each of us had kind of honed our personality. We had honed our on-air persona, if you want to say it. And I think that Cayman recognised with a lot of us that, like, when I listen back to 1989 now to some of the recordings, I think, seriously, I got a gig doing that. But I think he saw or heard something in all of us and reckoned that with his guidance and his direction, he could chip it away. He could chip away at it, and he could sculpt something. And I think he managed to do that, definitely.
And what kind of a station do you think Clare FM was in those early days? What kind of a service did it offer, and how did it differ from what was there before?
Oh, it was just fantastic. And I mean that sincerely, because, you see, there was a big build-up to this. The Clare Champion newspaper owned 25% of it, so it was in their best interest to keep the publicity going. There was no other outlet. There was no Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagram, no any of that, thanks be to God. So the only information that people got was on a Thursday from the Champion, as they say in Clare. And they still do get that. So the Clare Champion kept people very much informed as to what was happening and when it was going to happen. And from early August, they were profiling, ever so slightly, people like me and Áine Hennessy and Tommy Kelly from Galway and Austin Durack from Limerick, people that were going to be on the local radio station. They did a campaign teaching people how to retune their radio to 96.4. Cayman, his sister Anne, who was a producer on his programme, was there before us. Áine Hennessy had been there before me because she was doing recordings of the Willie Clancy Week in Milltown Malbay in July. And they had been going out purposely into the county, into calling into shops and to bars and to restaurants and saying, I am so-and-so, I will be working with the new station, we're going to be on air on this date. So there was a great level of anticipation. And people started to realise very early on that if a water main at the top of the street in Tulla broke, that was news now. That was news. And for Tulla people, you know, to be able to get that. The same applied if there was a truck blocking a street in Ennistymon. It was now news. So people realised very quickly that their community could feature very prominently on this local radio station. They also realised that they too had an opinion, which we all have, but they could voice it. They could actually ring up the radio station, go on air and say, I disagree with that, or I agree with that. Mm-hmm. So it was a magnificent transformation. And somebody, I can't recall who it was when we were doing the book, said, that will never happen again, no matter what. The internet couldn't even do that. So it was really exciting.
But how was that different from the pirate years before then? Because was there ever a Clare-wide pirate station, or were they more localised pirate stations in Ennis or whatever? I know there was Radio Clare there. I think there was West Coast Radio. How local were they? I mean, it sounds like, from what you say, that something very different was happening with Clare FM.
You answered your own question by saying that all of the radio stations, like all the pirates, the majority of them, were very local. And so you'd have the Ennis radio station. They would have a radius maybe of 10 miles. Okay. But I think the biggest thing that Clare FM did, and this goes back to you answering your question, is that it allowed people in the West to understand what was happening on the East and how life was there, and vice versa, and North and South and all that. People got to actually, it joined the county together. And it showed the differences and it showed the similarities in each area. And I think it brought the counties together in a way that nothing could.
Yeah. And tell us about the book then. What's the outline of the book, and what was your approach in writing it?
I just wanted everybody to have an opportunity to give a nice Christmas present, and that was that was really that's the plug over. I was sitting in the departure lounge in Shannon Airport back around April, I think. Just before Easter. And I have one of these heads for remembering dates and anniversaries and things like that. And for some reason, I know what I was doing. I was checking to see, I'm self-employed. So when you have time on your hands, you have to look ahead and think, okay, how am I going to get paid in June? How am I going to get paid in September? What am I going to be doing? And all that kind of stuff. And I was going through a kind of a calendar of events because I had one project just finished. I just started another one. And suddenly realised, hang on, 2019, Clare FM is 30 years. Local radio, independent radio is 30 years old this year in Ireland. And I thought, I have to be involved in something. I have to be, you know, I have to be somewhere in this. I have to contribute something to it. And I had no recollection of the 10th anniversary in Clare FM because I wasn't at it. Or the 20th, or the 21st, or the 25th. And I thought, well, I'm going to be part of the 30th. And I should be part of it. And I should tell the story. It took a while. It actually only took once I got the idea. It only took a few hours to actually come up with the idea of how the book would be. And one of the greatest questions, because I'm still involved with Clare FM, one of the greatest questions that I'm asked, or one of the most common questions is, where did so-and-so ever go to? Or where is so-and-so now? Now, we know where Marty Morrissey is. We know where Rachel English is. We know, those that are interested would know where the likes of Nympha Moroney is because she's the editor of 6-1. So they'd know that. But people on the street would have lost track of some people. And so I thought, here's an opportunity to reintroduce the original cast, as we'll call them, or the original crew. And would it be interesting? And would it be, could we make it and do it in such a way that it would be, there would be a historic element to it? And what can we put into it? And that's how I started thinking about it.
So essentially, it starts off then with a series of profiles of individual broadcasters.
The book itself starts off by saying that, look, up until 1989, there was only one local service that was legal in the country, and that was Cork Local Radio, which was an RTE spin-off, and it was only on for a few hours a day, as we know. It's still there. But essentially, there was nothing except RTE. And so I start with that, and then how the legislation was introduced by Ray Bourke, the Minister for Communications, how he established the IRTC, the Independent Radio and Television Commission, how they set about with their plan, the announcement of what they were going to do, when they were going, and the time frame in which they were going to do it. And they actually stuck to it, which was amazing. Within reason, the independent TV station didn't come online. Century Radio was a little bit later than they had hoped. But when you look at all of the local radio stations, they were pretty much on target. So I start with that. And then I do a little bit of a look at where Clare was, and how the application was put together, how they presented to the IRTC, who was involved. There were four different organisations looking for the franchise in Clare, so I gave them a mention. Spoke about the shareholders, obviously, who had basically put their hands in their pocket to do it. And then the start of it, really. And then I decided, right, let's take a look at the presenters. And it struck me that while we all started working around the same time, and I'd say to somebody like Alan Cantwell, Alan, you know, where were you working before? Oh, I was working in such a radio station in Dublin. And I'd say, oh, I know somebody. But I never knew their stories. And nobody ever asked me my story. And then I got to think about people listening to the radio never probably thought about us saying, I'd love a job on the radio, and how we went about applying for it. Áine Hennessy talks in the book about sitting on a train writing to Cayman Jones saying, dear Cayman, I'd love a job on your radio station, blah, 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 right? And her enclosing her CV and her demo tape and the whole lot. She came from RTE, but she still had to do this. She came from RTE where she did some work with Cayman, but she still did this. I did it. You know, various other people, everybody did it. We all had to go through numerous tests, and here we were. So I thought it'd be nice to share those stories. And a former broadcaster with RTE and with Clare FM, who was very helpful to me in the book, sent me a lovely note when he read it and said, I had worked with all of these people on a number of occasions, but I never knew their stories, and it was lovely to hear it. So I wanted kind of the human story to come out as well. And that's it. And that's essentially how the book was put together.
Ger Sweeney, author of the new book Launching Clare FM to celebrate 30 years of the station, and the book is available in bookshops in Galway and Clare for €15. It's excellent value because it's a really excellently produced book, a beautiful coffee table publication full of photographs of former broadcasters and their memories of the station's launch in 1989. The book can also be bought online at emeraldconnection.net. It's a fascinating insight into the people behind one of the West's most successful local stations, and we congratulate Ger Sweeney and all of those involved.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
In the last month, RTE announced a major cost-cutting plan to attempt to deal with its crippling budget deficit. The plan was leaked to the press just following the death of Gay Byrne and caused consternation among broadcasters in Donnybrook. There are to be some casualties on the radio side. All of the RTE digital radio stations are to be closed down, and Lyric FM, the classical music and cultural service, its presence in Limerick City is to end, with the station to be produced from Dublin and Cork from now on. Surprisingly, there's no mention of the longwave service to the Irish diaspora in the UK, so it looks like that will survive the axe once again. Last month, we spoke to Dr. Harry Brown, a senior lecturer in media at the Technological University of Dublin, when this was still in the realm of speculation. So I went back again to Harry recently for a more in-depth discussion of the bigger issues around the RTE cost-cutting plan, and also more generally the future of public service broadcasting in this era of media fragmentation. I began by asking Harry for his response to the RTE plan.
I think that RTE had to balance a number of competing interests. They obviously flew the kite early on of losing Lyric FM completely, so that the fact that they've kept Lyric FM is now seen as more of a local issue around Limerick rather than a kind of an existential question about its commitment to high culture. So that was interesting. And they've managed to spin it also in terms of cutting the salaries of big presenters, which is something that they seem to manage to do every few years as a kind of a look how hard we're working to do this. I always worry about notions of cost cutting in an institution like RTE, because very often it comes down to people, and not necessarily tossing people onto the breadline, but voluntary redundancies mean, and I saw this myself in the Irish Times, and I've seen it in RTE on occasions over the years, voluntary redundancies means loss of institutional memory, it means loss of senior people, it tends to exacerbate the phenomenon that we see in particular in journalism, in many institutions, of a kind of a sunken mid-career kind of demographic, if you like, that you got sort of young people coming in, usually on a freelance basis or poor contracts or even on internships. You've got old people who don't take packages because they don't think there's anything else for them to do, or they do it, you know, in lieu of retiring, in effect. But you've got a set of kind of mid-career people for whom it's worthwhile to take a package because they can move on to something else, particularly in a strong economy. But you lose them. You lose their experience. You lose their knowledge. You lose their contacts. You lose their institutional memory. And the phenomenon in so much media of a kind of amnesia, you know, where important issues seem to spring up and then vanish again, and nobody seems to be the holder of continuity, I think is exacerbated. And certainly everyone I know in every newspaper I know says something similar. And I think it's happened in RTE already. I mean, the number of really good people who've left RTE over the years is sad to consider. And I think that this plan will bring more of that. And I think that's always something that needs to be remembered, even when we talk about so-called voluntary redundancies. And I mean, the same goes in relation to situations like the Limerick situation, you know, that there will be a real loss of purpose and of commitment from people whose purpose and commitment was valuable to that institution, an institution that I'm very critical of an awful lot of the time, but an institution that nonetheless is the closest thing we have to a repository of kind of, you know, media knowledge, memory, and culture on a kind of a, certainly on a 26-county basis nationally here.
To look at one radio specific is the proposed closure of all of the digital stations. Now, they were very underfunded and digital radio is very poorly developed in Ireland. But is that a missed opportunity perhaps to develop services that are quite niche and that arguably would fulfil quite an important public service broadcasting function in themselves?
I think the loss of the digital radio stations is an interesting one. I mean, it's kind of sold partly as, you know, a necessity based on a technology that failed. Or a technology that certainly didn't catch on here. I think that is a somewhat narrow way of viewing it, though, because the fact that one particular mode of dissemination of a diverse range of stations has kind of never really caught on and is not widely adopted misses out on the fact that, you know, on mobile, on the web, the mode of dissemination is always available. It's always there. Now, I think we know that those services were underfunded. They weren't particularly interesting or particularly popular. But if there is to be a version of public service broadcasting that is both national and plural, that was certainly one kind of way of thinking about it. And if you were to be sort of conspiratorial about it, which I'm not, you could nearly say that that this particular moment of failure of pluralism can then be cited in future as evidence that the people don't really want a lot of little niche services. You know, they want to tune into one big, boring national broadcaster. And to some extent, I think that that argument has been ratified in a way that is unfair, because I think it is possible to do more, better, local community, and to do it without concern about using the DAB functionality, and instead, you know, do it with an app, do it on the web, do it, you know, obviously using the infrastructure of the internet that's available. And so I agree with the premise of your question that it's a lost opportunity, while at the same time, you know, I feel like an idiot because I have a DAB tuner sitting somewhere in the house that I never should have invested in, you know.
Well, I'd never bought one because DAB was never made available in Galway, and there's absolutely no chance of that ever happening now. So to come back to public service broadcasting, you've said you've been very critical of RTE in the past, but you also seem to have sympathy for the concept of public service broadcasting. So how can one robustly defend the notion of public service broadcasting while recognizing that RTE perhaps has contributed to some of its current woes?
Yeah, the idea that RTE has contributed to its current woes, I think, needs to be partly unpicked before I go on to say, you know, why defend RTE in the current circumstances. We sometimes talk about RTE's woes as though they were kind of a part of a natural process that, you know, unfolded inevitably and they should have seen it coming, the technology was changing, etc. But I think it's important to say that RTE's woes are also the result of a political process and of a set of political decisions and lack of decisions that have put it in the position that it finds itself, with the most obvious one being the failure to adapt the TV license to current technological and economic and commercial realities, so that, you know, it must be 10 years since Pat Rabbit started talking about a broadcasting charge to replace the TV license, and we still have nothing of the sort, and we're certainly not going to get it in the last few months of a government, to be sure. And that decision has really been an effective defunding of RTE and can't be overlooked in that respect. Another part of it is the problems with commercial revenue. RTE obviously has a dual funding model, commercial revenue going to international satellite broadcasters, commercial revenue going to big companies like Google and Facebook to a huge extent. And again, those are based on political, some might call them political realities, I would call them political decisions too, about how national and supranational institutions like the EU, like the authorities here, like the Federal Communications Commission in the United States, how they choose to regulate and not regulate these content providers, be it BSkyB, Facebook, or Google. And, you know, for all of these companies, the kinds of fines that the EU Commission might throw their way is a small externality, a tiny operating cost compared to the profits that they make on advertising that used to go, you know, going back 20 years, it used to go to newspapers, and going back 10, a lot more of it used to go to broadcasters. So I think that And obviously, you know, RTE also clearly has operates under some restrictions in terms of how it can exploit its advertising opportunities in the digital environment, partly because private sector competitors insist that it shouldn't be able to drive home its national status. So you sit watching a live program on RTE on the web, and you're left looking at a, you know, a kind of holding screen for 2 or 3 minutes during the ad break because RTE can't use that that slot for advertising. So it's a, you know, there are a number of regulatory and political decisions that have got RTE to the place where it is. But as you say, I'm critical of RTE, and I think that the reality of RTE's service, apart from some very, very good journalism, investigative work in particular, the reality of its service is distinctly mixed. But I defend it because to defend it is to defend the idea that media and journalism, which is my particular interest within media, are public goods. And that to leave them solely to the workings of the market is to, with maybe some small licensing requirements, for example, that a, you know, a pop radio station has, you know, a news broadcast occasionally, is to me an abnegation of the important public asset that the airwaves and the, you know, and the non-airwaves, the cables and the fiber optics and the computer networks represent. They're a public good. And to have a public service broadcaster, to consider funding it to be an important national priority, to see the provision of news and information in particular, but also of entertainment and culture as a public good that should be supplied at a kind of a, you know, at a fixed rate to all people, regardless of their ability to pay, and without, I think, without the necessity of advertising at all on the BBC model, but obviously we have long had a dual funding model. I think that's important. And so while I think there's a different version of public service that we can aspire to, that the obligation at the moment is to defend the one we have.
So what vision of public service broadcasting then do you think we should aspire to?
I think it's possible to imagine public service broadcasting in a more plural sense, you know, literally plural, that there are more public service broadcasters. You know, RTE, as we talked about a little bit before, had experimented with these various digital services, you know, aimed at niche markets. Clearly, we have non-commercial radio, including the work that you do yourself, John. We have non-commercial broadcasters available. But like those RTE niche services, it's woefully underfunded. They provide some really good programming and some really good experience for programmers, but they don't provide a genuine source of plurality, which is to say of pluralism, of diversity, within the Irish media landscape. I just had occasion last night to meet the diversity guy at RTE, and he interesting guy, and he seems to see his role as kind of going around RTE wagging his finger at everybody to be more diverse. When I think, you know, to some extent, you know, diversity has to mean, sure, that your kind of main centralized programming reflects more properly and completely the richness of the population in terms of abilities, in terms of capacity, in terms of ethnic and racial background, in terms of gender and sexuality, in terms of class and economic status. For sure, that all needs to be done. But I mean, you know, there's only so much diversity you can do in a, you know, in the time limited frame. And, you know, RTE has essentially, by cutting all those niche services, has cut back its time. I think we need to be making more time, more places and more spaces, if diversity is a value. And I think it is. Sometimes a tricky one, but a real one, pluralism is the way that you deliver it.
We touched on this before when we spoke before about this. That raises the question, if you look at radio in terms of something as mainstream and as general as 2FM, But it also draws attention then to the underfunded niche services that you mentioned, and indeed the soon-to-be-scrapped digital services. But is 2FM not a very large elephant in the room in terms of the radio landscape, in that it could be legitimately accused of repeating what other commercial stations are doing already and not funding, not serving any obvious public broadcasting function at all?
Yeah, it's a tough question about 2FM. And my general feeling is, sure, why is RTE doing what a commercial station can do? But I think there is an answer to that. One is obviously financial. There are also ways of delivering a popular product that have certain other kinds of values built into it, you know, about, for example, about the, you know, about the diversity of the pop music that you play, diverse origins, diverse voices presenting it, where you know, an engagement with popular culture that doesn't treat it simply as you know, throwaway, you know, spin the dial to hear the same song.
So something more similar to BBC Six Music, then, perhaps.
Yeah, something like that. I think that offers that definitely offers one model. I don't know how well BBC6 Music is doing in terms of audiences, and whether 2FM, I know 2FM has certainly had its ups and downs, and mostly downs over recent times in terms of its audience, and it may feel, you know, and particularly in light of the listening habits of young pop fans, that it has an increasingly niche service provision already, without having to, you know, turn it somehow into something more cultural or intellectual. I know my 14-year-old daughter does not listen to any of those radio stations. It's really funny. I mean, I recently got a car. I got a new car, and I've had it for about 2 months, and I have not had to find Spin FM or Beat, or, you know, for you people out in the West, these are some of the
iRadio,
right? Yeah, Uncle Fergal. And I haven't had to tune in those stations. And my daughter's in the car a lot, but she plugs in her phone, plays Spotify over Bluetooth, and that's the entertainment. So I think that even pop radio finds itself in a situation, and in some sense, I mean, I spoke earlier about denaturalizing this kind of decline and not always sort of blaming the technology, the internet broke it kind of thing. But I think that there is, in relation to pop broadcasting, there is clearly an issue with the model in terms of how the audience finds itself consuming this kind of product.
Dr. Harry Brown, a senior lecturer in media in the Technological University of Dublin.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Last month, we featured the Radio Refugee Network based in Germany, and we stay with that theme now, and an extract from a presentation by the academic Katie Moylan here at NUI Galway last summer at a conference about resilience in alternative and community media. Katie is a lecturer in the Department of Media and Communication at the University of Leicester in the UK, and is a researcher on community radio and author of the book Broadcasting Diversity, Migrant Representation in Irish Radio, and the recent publication, The Cultural Work of Community Radio. Katie worked and lived in Ireland in the past and spent some time as a volunteer with us here on Flirt FM, as well as working in the pirate radio scene in Dublin. In this extract, Katie talks about her research on immigrants using community radio in Ireland and the US.
Another person I really like around theorizing community is Miranda Joseph, who has a great book, Against the Romance of Community, again at the end, where she really systematically takes apart this idea of community that circulates, which is a kind of warm, fuzzy, romanticized thing that makes us all feel good. And both Harvey and Joseph are very good at saying, no, it's more complicated than that. It has to do with being inside, it has to be doing with outside. And Joseph here, for instance, talks about the communal subjectivity created by being part of a self-selecting community, constituted not by a top-down idea of identity, right, a top-down categorization of oneself, but rather through as practices of production and consumption. And I like this because it opens up this understanding of community and participation, meaningful participation, as being listener-generated as well, right? So everyone's kind of coalescing around a community as enabled, facilitated by, in this instance, community-produced radio shows. Okay. So I like this because it opens up ways that we understand community in the context of analyzing how this work affects community. So to go back to some examples, I want to start just when I first realized the important work that community radio can do was when I was doing my PhD here in Ireland, in Dublin. And at the time I was doing this, this was from interviews I did with presenters from a program called African Scene, made by then Anna Olivia FM in Dublin, which is now, I think, Dublin City. And what was happening is I was analyzing, because at that time there's a lot of talk about the then new migrant groups in Ireland in the 2000s. And so RTE gamely stepped up and said, here's a couple of programs showcasing these new migrants, but they didn't really go far enough. They were quite multicultural. They foregrounded difference qua difference and didn't really go deep into the experience that migrants were, that, you know, kind of running into every day. The first one was better, Different Voices, because that was produced by a man from Senegal rather than Melanie Vervoord, who did Spectrum. That's digression. I felt that RTE wasn't going far enough in enabling meaningful representation of this really diverse set of communities. And then I came across African Scene on Anna Olivia. And on African Scene, when I tuned in just to kind of explore what was happening, they were just talking about racism in depth and their experiences of that. And I thought, this is not happening on radio anywhere that I've ever seen. And that began, I did work in community radio, I worked in pirate radio, but that began my scholarly interest in community radio because I saw that work being done. So this is how, there was two presenters. It was Lizelle Joseph and TJ Adoro. And TJ was from Nigeria, Yoruba speaking, and Lizelle is from South Africa. But they call African Scene, but as you can see, they really felt their listenership and their community was more than, certainly Africa's a continent anyway, so they have two country perspectives. Within both of those countries, they're complex countries. They have their own kind of affiliations and groups. But they were also speaking to how it felt to be a migrant living in Dublin. And they addressed, say, experiences of racism much more widely from that perspective. So they see themselves as immigrants, you know. That was their subjectivity as well. Lizelle was also very, very involved and very dedicated to representing a feminist set of principles and her contributions to the show. So already have layers, right? Layers of affiliation that they're producing through this show called African Scene, you know? And they absolutely encourage call-ins. Community practitioners will know some people have a call-in facility, some people don't. There are good reasons against it because it's risky, but there are awesome reasons for it because meaningful participation that's live. They had that facility. This was in reaction to news coverage, to paper coverage, and ways in which migrants were being framed in Irish newspaper coverage. And Lizelle saying, look, this just isn't good enough. This is a reductive representation. And again, we see this, but this was just not happening on radio, and it needs to be, I think. And so this is one of a much, much longer transcript of a much more developed show and set of shows. Okay, so in doing this, what was happening with this show is if you were a new migrant to Dublin, if you lived in the neighborhood, if you had an interest in the way that Dublin was changing, if you had if you experienced racism yourself, you could, this is something speaking to your experience more, okay? So therefore you're pulled in to a kind of a familiar discussion that wasn't happening, as I say, and certainly not in the mainstream. The then government were talking about making illegal Irish immigrants in the States at that time kind of like regularizing their status. I feel like this is always an issue. I just always feel like everyone should be able to work and live wherever they want. But they made the very excellent point here that, you know, this is a category, you know, this is a category error. How is like one set of immigrants considered viable and the others are not at the same time? And I just think this is so important that they pulled this out and recognized it and said, okay, this is, we really need to talk about this, and this is not being talked about. Okay. So that's one example, which I think goes to ideas also of how community radio can speak truth to power and has a duty, a self-imposed duty, a self-declared duty of accountability. Okay. and, as someone said earlier today, of critique of the mainstream as well. Yeah. So this is an example from a different program in New Orleans, La Voix de Haiti, which is from a community station there called WRBH. New Orleans is slightly unusual, I believe, in the U.S. context, in that it has three licensed community stations, which is quite a lot for the size of the city. So what I like about this is, again, and this is much later, this is in relation to the book that's just out, is that this host was talking about these layers of affiliation again. So this program is entirely in Haitian Creole. So as he says, he's speaking to his community. But he differentiates, as indeed we all do, right, from our subjectivity, our identity position. You know, what is his first affiliation? Does he feel more Haitian or more New Orleanian? These are familiar questions. And just seeing this articulated, if you're Haitian and living in New Orleans, here's, again, a program that you can turn into. You hear your language, you hear your dialect, you hear your accent, but you also have a place where you can listen to experiences of not just being Haitian, but being Haitian in New Orleans, and what's that about? And say, for instance, what's the Haitian experience of Haitian music in New Orleans, which is very popular in New Orleans, again, because it's great. But also it manifests a particular way in New Orleans culture, which is very musically savvy and driven and has a lot of depth and nuance there. That's what I'm unpacking from there, because it's a longer conversation, I remember it. I like the way that he's articulating those layers. That's why I think that quote is useful. Now I want to talk a little bit about a show called The Morning Drive, and this is out of WSRF in Miami. And WSRF is, I don't think they have, they don't have a community license. Licensing for community stations and LP stations in the U.S. is a big thing that I'm only getting to grips with. It's really not very clear to me, the criteria, in contrast to the European context where you have a recognized third sector. And certainly in the UK, we have a very recognized, as Laurie will be able to tell you, and Salvo will be able to tell you, a very recognized sector that is the community sector. It doesn't seem to be that way in the US. WSRF, I looked at its license in detail at the FCC, and I still can't understand it, but what it does do is it brands itself as the first Haitian station in the nation. And it speaks to the substantial, yeah, I love that. And they know it too. They know it's catchy because they're radio people. But they broadcast too, and located geographically within Little Haiti in Miami. And the Haitian population communities in Miami is at least 10,000, if not more. So it's a very substantial and entrenched community. The Morning Drive is interesting because it's got this really normative sounding name, The Morning Drive, which is like your anodyne Monday through Friday drive time program in the morning. So 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. doing that drive time slot. It was run at the time that I was talking to. It's still going. You can find it on Facebook, The Morning Drive. Unfortunately, the three practitioners I spoke to are no longer running it. And I think the guys doing it now are doing a great job, but these guys, as you see, just brought something unique. And what they did, they were all working at volunteer level, so a lot of work, because Monday through Friday, 2 hours. But they did this thing which they called Kringlish in terms of their broadcasting. So any given program, they would move between Haitian Creole and English in a sentence. Community radio lends itself to kind of translingual programming, and they just do this, but they've thought really hard about why they do this and the reasons for doing it. So these are second generation Haitians. Two of them were born in Miami to Haitian parents. The third had come over from Haiti when she was six. But you know, they went to school in Miami, so they have English, but they're speaking Creole at home. The other thing that's not here is actually in Haiti, I was told the radio language isn't Creole, but it's actually French, because that's their formal language of record. So they're getting criticized on all sides from older people saying not that they should be speaking Creole, but they should be speaking French, or that they should stick to one language and not another. So they feel this. They were batting this out of the park, as you can see. Again, they're articulating their subjectivity, okay, their experience. And they're articulating that to the two or three generations they need to speak to. So that's their peers, and their peers, and they have a lot. Their content is all entertainment and gossip and celebrity stuff. It's great. But they need to speak to their peers and be relatable to their peers, but they also need to be respectful to the older members of their community and speak quite literally in their language. So they're speaking from their situated place. They're their Miami home, their little Haiti home, and their linguistic home, as it were.
Dr. Katie Moylan of the Department of Media and Communication at the University of Leicester.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
And finally, staying with minority language media and to a sister language of Irish, Scottish Gaelic, which is spoken by only 1% of the population of Scotland, but despite its small population base, is fairly well represented in media. Since the 1980s, Gaelic has had its own dedicated radio station, Radio na Gael, and a television station, BBC Alaba, since 2008. At a recent conference on minority language media held in Edinburgh, I met the broadcaster, author and sports commentator Hugh Dan McLennan, who was involved with Radio na Gael since the early days, and I asked him to describe how he became involved in Gaelic broadcasting.
Most of my generation in the mid-70s were very fortunate to be, I suppose, in a way, screened or handpicked by the then head of Gaelic radio, as he was, the late Fred Macaulay. He was very good to us as students because he came around the Gaelic departments. He knew everybody who was in the Gaelic departments at that time. It didn't matter where they were from. He was very familiar with everybody. But he used to give us little jobs like reading parts of drama scripts or what eventually we realised he was doing was kind of career spotting, that he identified people from different parts of the Gaelic-speaking community who he thought would be good in different parts of the broadcasting setup as it was then, very much a fledgling organisation. It wasn't really a structure at that time, and they didn't have the output we were eventually to have within 10 and 15 years. So it was good for us. We got some pocket money out of it, but more importantly, we got experience of working in the major BBC studios. So when it came to the point of deciding on your career, we really had two choices. One was to go teaching, and one was to go to the BBC if you were fortunate enough to be picked. I chose to go teaching because I wanted to get that extra security of having a teaching certificate. But I think I always knew I would end up in broadcasting, and that's what happened. I went to teach in Inverness in 79 and left there in 83 to go and work with the BBC Gaelic Radio Service and Radio Highland, as it was then, the English-speaking service in Inverness.
So can you explain the extent, the limited extent of Gaelic broadcasting then in 1983 when you went into that sector?
Prior to me joining, there had been some development work which was really the kernel or the model which established the working practices of BBC Gaelic Radio for decades after that, and that was the Western Isles service, which was Radio na Nyilan, as it was called, servicing the Western Isles. It was bilingual, but it was a very high Gaelic content, obviously, because of where it was, and that was an opt-out of the BBC Radio Scotland system, so it kind of dropped out of Radio Scotland at various points in the day. Where we were working in Inverness, we very famously at one point round about then had what was called the Gaelic Minute, and one minute of every day was slotted into the news bulletin or into the schedule for, I can't even remember now what it was at the time, but it was, in some ways, it was useful because it became a bit of a laughingstock, because it was absolute nonsense that only 1 minute was devoted to Gaelic broadcasting. And I suppose if you were to take a cynical view of it, some people might have been using that as a kind of stick to hit the BBC with eventually, and that's what happened. And when I joined in 83, in the spring of 83, I went in on the technical side, actually, which was a benefit to me longer term, because it gave me fantastic insight into things like how to work with producers and how to manage recordings and all the rest of it, which came in really useful. But within 4 or 5 years, we had the establishment in 1985 of the full Gaelic radio service called Radio na Gael, which Neil Fraser, who was then the head of Radio Scotland and a Gaelic speaker from Sky, drove. And what was interesting was that in the previous probably 10 years, the BBC hierarchy of Neil and Fred Macaulay and other individuals had identified enough people to sustain what was a gigantic leap in output, because we moved from next to nothing to be doing, I think it was half an hour in the morning, half an hour at 12 o'clock, and then evening bulletins, whereas before we would have been servicing things like 5 minutes every night, and maybe one or two nights a week you would have a half-hour programme or current affairs. And, you know, by 1985 then we started doing things like international football, live international football from... I remember World Cup campaigns at Wembley and all the rest of it. So actually, I think what we were doing unconsciously, if we look back at it, was laying the foundations for the fledgling television service in not too long after that. And a lot of the people moved on. And interesting, if you go back to the 70s, a lot of the people who were activists complaining about the lack of Gaelic on radio, there was VHF. Gaelic was put on the VHF service, and they coined this phrase quite cleverly. The students who marched on the BBC at the time, very hard to find, which was quite...
Of course, it was quite true, because it was fledgling. It was very much the alternative that many radio receivers didn't have.
Exactly, and most of the Gaelic community in particular didn't have it, and here was Gaelic being launched on it. But it was actually a masterstroke by Fred Macaulay to establish the whole principle. But a lot of these students then went on, funnily enough, to become senior figures in Radio Na Gael, and then senior figures in the television industry, and even beyond. Ken Macquarie is, you know, now up in the higher echelons of the BBC in the UK. So, you know, the groundwork we did and the people we had, I suppose, a bit of luck. The generation we had, there were good Gaelic speakers, they were smart people, and they adapted and they took the BBC on.
And politically, how did you get to the situation that you had a full service from 1985? How politically, what changes had to be made in order to bring about that massive increase in service?
Well, a lot of it started, it was actually kicked into action in the 70s with the students' action, and we often reflect on that. Where is the student activity nowadays, which would mirror what happened in the 70s? And that kind of galvanised the Gaelic community into believing that there was a way of achieving what they wanted. And after that, it was, I suppose you could say, we infiltrated the BBC by getting so many Gaelic speakers into the system. And that in itself created some tensions, I remember, in the early days, where there was, the only word I can put to it is, there was some jealousy about the rapidity with which there was a kind of, to quote the often used phrase, the Gaelic mafia, the Gaelic suits were taking over the BBC in Scotland, which was to some extent right, because Gaelic speakers, or a lot of the senior staff were Gaelic speakers. You could say a lot of the Gaelic speakers were senior staff. You take your pick. But we had good people, I think, at the end of the day, and some of our broadcasters who trained in Gaelic radio at that time went on. John Morrison, I can quote, was the BBC's, the UK BBC television correspondent in Scotland. I mean, we had people of that calibre in the system. And in fact, that was recognised politically within the BBC. A lot of work was done by Fred Macaulay, Neil Fraser in particular, by breaking the mould, at getting the BBC to accept certain things had to happen. And you can't go past that without mentioning people like William Carragher, who was the manager in Inverness, Martin MacDonald, the senior journalist, and perhaps above all, the late DG, Alistair Milne, who was himself a great supporter of Gaelic, and I suspect, if truth be told, took plenty of decisions and gave Neil Fraser and people like Fred a lot of support when he was putting himself on the line. So there was a lot of internal BBC politics to get us to where we were, but there was also the BBC calling our bluff. They actually didn't give us a lot of time to set the radio service up, and they did the same when television eventually came in 2008. It was almost like, right, do it, but do it in 6 months. Yeah. And that's a huge challenge. But we had the resources to meet that in 85, and that goes down to the planning, bit of luck, and the resources being there at the time, but also the community knowing what it wanted and asking us to deliver it, and we were in a position to do that.
So what did the community want, and what kind of a service did you develop, and how did that expand over time?
Well, we went for the full trick. We went from local news bulletins where people were reporting their sheep and their missing cats and all the rest of it, the local, the grist to the mill of local community radio was was then translated into the full panoply of BBC services, where we matched our target as fledgling reporters and producers at that time was to be as good as Radio Scotland was, if not better, to be quicker, to be faster, but also to be, and I don't mean this in an advocate sense, but the voice of the community, because they didn't have a voice, because the central BBC still is to some extent, and it's criticised for being very Glasgow or Central Belt centric. We, through Radio Na Nealan, had established that the BBC could operate in the heart of the Gaelic community. We then set up the satellite stations, Inverness in particular. Glasgow still retained a lot of the power because it was just the biggest part of the BBC, so understandably a lot of the superstructure was there. But eventually you had remote studios set up in Oban and Argyllshire, which is still there. Inverness was key to the whole thing and developed on the back of BBC Highland, so you had an English operation and a Gaelic operation. But gradually the BBC realised that bilingual staff were actually very efficient. So instead of two people going out to jobs, you would have one person going out doing the job in Gaelic and English. That suited the BBC, and I think that was an important factor as well, because the tills started to ring just a little bit more slowly because we were providing them with something. And now you have a lot of things. I mean, most of the current weather presenters on BBC Scotland Television are actually Gaelic speakers because they can do it in both. So you train a person in one language, but they can do two jobs.
Gaelic is very weak as a community language and under a lot of pressure. To what extent do you think has Radio Na Gael contributed to the vitality of the language in the community?
I think when we look back in, you know, maybe another 50 years' time, wherever we are, we'll look back on that decade between 75 and 85 and see that perhaps then the seeds were sown, maybe not what halted the decline of Gaelic, but certainly what slowed it down, because most of the Gaelic community here, certainly in the last few years, are hearing more Gaelic through the radio than they will hear on their daily lives. And what they do is they hear everything being discussed in Gaelic, whether it's international affairs, fishing, local politics, national politics. Sport in particular has been a huge driver of the television and the radio service. Schools, younger children's programming was the mould was set for that in Radio Na Nealan, because they created, you know, the choice of using English records on pop programmes was groundbreaking at the time, and there was a lot of hostility towards that, but it brought in the young generation who then followed Gaelic radio as it developed. So I think the biggest contribution they've made is that almost, it feels like 24 hours a day. It's not really, I suppose it's 12 hours a day in reality with repeats at either end of it. But there is Gaelic output on radio, and that nowadays is very important even to an international audience, because through the web and so on.
Hugh Dan McLennan speaking about his involvement in Radio Na Gael, a radio station broadcasting in Scottish Gaelic. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM. Join us again after the holidays in January for more radio news and features from home and abroad. I hope you'll be able to join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on Facebook.com/Wireless Flirt. You can also listen to previous shows on wirelessflirt.radio.ie, where you can also subscribe to our new podcast. We're available on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, Castbox, Player.fm, Podcast Addict, and Acast. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening and a very happy Christmas.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Bye.